Kenneth Thompson, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So before we dive into your work, could you tell me what biodiversity actually is?
Oh my God. How long have you got?
Well, we can go the entire show if it takes that long, but I know a lot of people use the term and don't really know what it means. So if there's a simple definition, it'd be much appreciated.
Yeah, well, simply, I mean, it's easy, really. I mean, it's just the whole of life, everything, from, you know, bacteria, fungi, upwards to elephants and primates. But that's easy to say. But the big question is, of course, how much of that biodiversity do we know anything about? And the answer to that question is almost none of it. We don't really know how much there is. I mean, we just don't. I mean, I could go on a bit if you'd like me to about why we don't know.
Yeah, why don't we know? Why don't we know?
Why don't we know? Because there's far too much, and most of it is far too small and far too inconspicuous. So biologists argue still, this debate never ends, about how many species there are. You know, I mean, you could start with the number of species that we've actually identified to the point where we've managed to give them a name. And that's, well, I don't know, the last count, 1 million, 2 million, who knows? Everyone agrees there are a lot more than that, that we've just not even noticed yet. So we know nothing about them at all. We just know they must be out there. And there are all kinds of reasons for that. One is that to an extent that most people can't really understand nearly everything. In fact, to a first approximation, everything is rare. I mean, you notice the handful of species around you that are really common. You notice rabbits and you notice occasionally hedgehogs and oak trees. But they're very, very unusual. Almost all species are rare. And that's on top of being small and inconspicuous. So we know nothing about them. We don't know where they are. We don't know what they're called. We don't know how they make a living. We don't know whether they're increasing or decreasing. We don't know whether to worry about them. We don't know what would happen if they disappeared. Probably nothing. We don't know. And this makes, I mean, it's a separate question, but this makes conservation a nightmare if you actually stop for a moment and really think about what conservation is all about, or meant to be all about.
What is it meant to be all about, then?
Well, what is it meant to be all about? You tell me. When did you last hear anyone? When did you last hear anyone actually discuss what conservation is supposed to be doing? Do you ever hear anyone?
Not really, no.
Talk about that?
It's normally just discussions about saving a particular megafauna species or a famous species that people tend to care about. That's normally the conversation.
But here's the problem. What do we conserve? I mean, why we conserve what we want to conserve is a separate question. But first of all, just a simple thing. What do we conserve? What are the criteria? Bearing in mind that most of the species out there, we don't even know whether they are there or not. We don't know anything about them. And they're very rare. So where do we start? I mean, if you look around, people who conserve stuff for a living don't spend a lot of time thinking about this. And when you do start thinking about it, you can begin to see why, frankly. Because one criterion that's been very popular in the past is rarity. Yeah? And yet rarity is a waste of time, because all rarity says is you could serve everything, because everything's rare. So that's simple. So that doesn't move you on at all. that just takes you back to square one. So then what do you say? Well, another popular criterion that's been used in the past is nativeness. We like native species. We don't like alien species.
Yes, yeah. Red squirrels versus grey squirrels.
Et cetera. Exactly. But that was never a very good criterion, to be honest, of what to conserve, for various reasons. And we could spend an enormous amount of time talking about that, frankly. I've written a whole book about this, Where Do Camels Belong? Which is about why most people have got, you know, the wrong idea about native species, about native alien species. And most people don't even know what's native and what's alien.
Well, yeah, because most people, I think rabbits were native, but weren't they introduced to Britain in the Norman or Roman times, for example?
Rabbits are one of my favourite examples, actually, because what rabbits reveal is that we use being alien as a stick to beat species that we didn't like anyway.
Mm.
So rabbits and hares are close relations, okay? As you can tell by looking at them. Hares are not so common, and we kind of like hares. You know, there's a biodiversity action plan for hares. People spend good money conserving hares. Rabbits, we don't like. Rabbits, we regard as vermin, you know. But both are introduced. Neither is a native British species.
Oh, wow. I didn't know hares were introduced. Oh,
hares are introduced. Hares are introduced. Rabbits are introduced. But no one ever mentions that hares are introduced, because it would be embarrassing to do so. It'd be positively impolite to refer to hares' alien status, because we like hares. So we just pass over the fact that hares are not native and move on. Well, let's be fair here. I'm talking about the brown hare, the common hare.
Yeah.
The Arctic hare, which lives on Scottish mountains. This is the one that turns white in the winter. That's native. But the ordinary brown hare, the lowland brown hare, is introduced. So nativeness was never very good, and we never applied it very consistently anyway. But what's happened recently, of course, is that climate change means that nativeness is even less use than it used to be as a criterion of what to conserve. Because conserving native biodiversity in an age of climate change really is trying to push water uphill, frankly. I mean, just to give you an example, Kew Gardens were somewhat galvanized by how many of their trees died in 2022, which you recall was very hot and very dry.
Mm.
So they've just completed this major kind of forward-looking exercise, because Kew Gardens is all about trees. It's what they grow, basically. And they have to think. They have to think on a long scale, on a long time scale. If you're growing trees, you do. And what they've concluded is that it's simply a waste of time, a queue, planting almost all the common native British trees. Because by the end of the century, they won't survive the queue.
Wow.
Queue will just not be suitable for them. If you plant oak or birch, you know, now you're wasting your time. They're going to die. So nativeness is a rubbish criteria for what to conserve anyway. So what have we dealt with? We dealt with the two biggies, yeah?
Yeah.
Rarity, useless. Nativeness, yeah. Useless. What does that leave us with?
Exactly, yeah.
Well, what does it leave us with? To be honest, not a lot, really. I mean, I was quite enthusiastic. When I wrote Pandas, which is what has provoked this conversation, that's a long time ago. It's 15 years ago now,
yeah,
that I wrote Pandas. And, you know, I had to kind of remind me what I was thinking.
Yeah.
When I wrote it, to be honest, because
how's your opinions and the way you were thinking changed in the last 15 years from what you know now?
I think when I wrote Pandas, I was quite enthusiastic about ecosystem services as a third alternative. In other words, we try to preserve the things that are happening that make the world habitable, essentially, that keep us alive, that supply water and soil and stuff. And I kind of still agree with that. It's hard to disagree with that. It's hard to disagree with that, but I have friends and I have colleagues, in particular an old colleague of mine called Jonathan Silvertown, who also writes books on this kind of subject. He's at the University of Edinburgh. You could have fun talking to him too. That would be very interesting. He's got quite revisionist ideas about ecosystem services. And the more time goes on, the more I think I perhaps agree with him.
What do you mean by revisionist?
Well, he doesn't think that ecosystem services are the panacea for what we should be conserving. One of his problems is one that I referred to in Pandas, which is that it doesn't bring out the best in people to try to monetize nature. For reasons that I'm sure psychologists have spent, you know, entire careers trying to work out, when you raise the question of money, you tend not to get the best out of people. Once people are made to think about what things cost, they're not inclined to pay. Basically, you know, there's a famous study where Australians were asked, you know, about declining birds, you know, and how would they feel if a particular native bird were to go extinct? And nearly all of them said, well, they'd be very sad, you know. But the next question was, how much would they be prepared to pay to save it? And the answer from most of them was, nothing.
Wow.
You know,
wow.
Like they wouldn't be. So it doesn't help. And also, it's interesting. Ecosystem services are, they ought to do the job when you think about it. They ought to do the job because if people understand the extent to which everything about them in the world, everything that their life depends on ultimately is a product of the natural world. That the soil that crops are grown in, that the air they breathe, that the water they drink is a product of the natural world. They would value that natural world a bit more than if they don't know that. And that seems like a really good argument. But Jonathan also says in conversation that if you look for evidence that making people think about ecosystem services has actually benefited biodiversity, the actual evidence that it's been good for biodiversity, there's very little there. It doesn't seem to work. It ought to work. I mean, heavens, you know, makes sense. But in the end, you have to go where the evidence takes you. It's no good saying, just repeating over and over, well, it really ought to work, you know. It must work. Surely it works. It doesn't seem to work very well.
Where does the evidence take us then, if that doesn't work?
I don't know where the evidence takes us, frankly. I think in the end, you come down to this kind of almost religious sort of moral imperative, you know, that the natural world doesn't belong to us. It's not there for our benefit. Although actually, you know, going back to religion, most religions say it is. Most religions say that's exactly what it's there for. But it's not. And therefore, there's a kind of moral imperative not to leave the world more depauperate in everything than you found it. And that's a good argument if you like that kind of argument. Lots of people don't like that kind of argument. Lots of people find that wishy-washy and, you know, not very appealing. Because in a sense, it doesn't move you on. In a sense, all that does is tells you, well, you should try and conserve everything. But in fact, one thing it does tell you, I think, is that conserving individual species is probably a mug's game.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. And there is lots of evidence that spending tons of money on conserving individual species doesn't have very good outcomes, generally speaking.
So does the current UK projects or plans to reintroduce species such as maybe lynx and wolves in Scotland, what do you think about that kind of?
That's just brilliant because that's not about lynx and it's not about wolves. That's about restoring functioning ecosystems.
Okay, yeah.
Because what we find easy to forget in the 21st century is what a weird place the natural world is now compared to how it ought to be or was before we started destroying it. Yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, it's different in so many ways, on so many levels, and to such a huge extent that it's hard to know where to begin.
Well, what would the likely effect be if we introduced, for example, lynx back into Scotland? What would be the likely outcome of that?
The effects could be very dramatic, very dramatic. Because one of the things that everyone agrees with pretty good reason, I think, is that we're a bit short of trees in Britain.
Yeah, definitely.
Britain's been deforested. You know, when William the Conqueror arrived, Britain was a largely treeless country. And it's been like that ever since, frankly. And too many tree-eating herbivores, specifically deer,
yeah,
doesn't help that. It makes growing trees very difficult. I mean, don't get me started on planting trees either. I'm going off down a bit of a rabbit hole at this point, but one of the problems with the ecosystem services argument is that it gives organizations, it gives companies, corporations who don't really care, frankly, about anything other than their image, something to do that makes it look like they do care.
Yeah.
And that is on what comes under the general heading of biodiversity offsetting. Yeah. In other words, you're making a mess of all kinds of things all over the place. But as long as somewhere you're paying for something to be done that looks like it's benefiting biodiversity, that's fine. And the something, of course, is planting trees. And planting trees, frankly, is about the most useless activity ever. I know it's terribly popular these days, but trust me, trees do not need planting. I mean, they really don't.
Do they just need space to basically plant themselves or disperse the seeds themselves?
They need space and opportunity to plant themselves. Given that space and opportunity, trees are extremely good at planting themselves. And in fact, across quite large chunks of Europe now, in the uplands of Italy and France and Spain, where for economic reasons there's rural depopulation, trees are back. Trees are back by the shed load. I mean, millions of hectares of trees have just planted themselves. And all that's happened is people have stopped farming. So they've stopped ploughing and stopped grazing. And once you do that, you know, give trees any opportunity and they're in there like a shot. And what's also back across these areas that have all these trees in Italy and Spain and France is wolves.
Yeah.
Wolves are back. Really back. Back in a big way. So much so that there's quite a lot of pushback now from people who keep sheep for a living.
Yeah, yeah.
There are ways around that. You could deal with that.
Would reintroducing wolves be possible in the UK currently with the amount of space we have and the amount of forest we have and the amount of sheep we have?
Wolves are a difficult one. Britain's not a very big... England? Where would you put wolves in England? Yeah? I mean, seriously. Scotland? Yeah, I think Scotland. I mean, huge opposition, obviously, from farmers, and with, you know, very good reason.
Yeah.
But frankly, in the great scheme of things, compensating farmers for losing a few sheep, it's peanut.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's the administrative burden. It's the faffing about actually organising how that would be done, the paperwork that puts people off. The cost is trivial. And the other carnivore, of course, lynx, which is also following the wolves across Europe. I mean, more lynx than ever. Lynx is less of a problem. Lynx live at low densities. They are forest animals. They are deer specialists. They wouldn't eat many sheep. So I think the argument for reintroducing the lynx is a no-brainer, personally.
Yeah.
And I think what you have to do here is put yourself in the position of imagine you lived in a world where the lynx, against all odds, had actually survived as a native animal until the 21st century. Imagine you lived in that country. What would you think about lynx now? What would everyone think about lynx now? Yeah. They would be a conservation icon.
Yeah, they'd be a keystone species, surely.
They would be a keystone species. They would be a major tourist attraction. They would be a major industry organizing lynx spotting tours. I mean, there would be societies dedicated to their conservation and protection.
I mean, I'd definitely be traveling up with my camera to try and photograph them if they were in Scotland.
you would be trying to see them. I would be trying. Everyone, we would love our lynx. And the idea that just because we've managed through carelessness and whatever to lose them, that we should now not reintroduce them. I think if you put yourself in the position of, are they still here, you would love them.
Yeah.
What's not to love? You know, bring them back. And they would help to, basically they would help to control the deer. And if you control the deer, because there's no other way of controlling deer. People say, oh, you could shoot deer. But shooting deer it's expensive. It shoots. It kills the wrong animals. Shooting deer is natural selection in reverse. The deer people want to shoot are the big, successful deer with big antlers. But they're not the deer that would be killed by wolves and by lynx. It would be the old, the sick, the lame, the very young. That's how ecosystems work. And that's how they should work. But I mean, the experience right across Scotland now is that if only you make a big effort and control deer, been done in the Cairngorms, in the Cairngorms National Park, massive expansion of trees, mostly by natural regeneration, simply by controlling deer a bit better. But the easy way to do that is to have some proper predators for a change.
Well, think about the amount of money that would probably save in costs if we just had a lynx to outsource the deer extermination.
Exactly. And it would be a tiny step back towards a functioning ecosystem that had the large animals in it that ecosystems have always had before humans came along and killed them. I mean, the earth used to be knee-deep in big animals everywhere. Big.
There used to be cave lions in the UK, didn't there? And hyenas or something like that.
Yeah. The whole world had this fantastic collection of animals that it's hard to imagine now. They look like science fiction, like South American ground sloths.
Yes, yeah.
The size of tanks. I mean, could you imagine?
It'd be amazing. It'd be incredible, wouldn't it?
I mean, they're just, it makes, and that's, you know, that's just not, that's not, That's not unusual. The whole world was like that. I mean, there are bits of the world where this happened so recently that we almost saw it happen. I mean, New Zealand, for example, when the ancestors of the Maoris arrived in New Zealand, they found a country, a world with no land predators at all. So they had moas because they only had birds. The birds, flightless birds, 12 feet tall. I mean, and hunted by the world's largest eagle, Haast's eagle, had a 12-foot wingspan.
Wow.
And the Maoris, well, the moas were just a source of, you know, free food.
Yeah.
So they killed them all. And then the eagle had nothing to eat and the eagle went extinct. And it's all gone.
Mm.
So it's absolutely amazing to think what the world used to be like. And we could, you know, we could just take a few steps towards recreating that, usually without too much difficulty, where the animals still exist. Then you don't need to worry about the biodiversity in a sense. Then you don't need to worry about the fact that there are millions of species out there, most of which are insects, most of which no one will ever notice, and they will never be even named and described, because you are preserving ecosystems and you hope that those animals will, all those rare animals, tiny rare animals, will continue to survive somewhere out there, even if you don't know about them.
So if we give nature space to regenerate and bring back some of the megafauna, is that one of the best solutions?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And you can see this happening. You can see this happening. It's happening in the sea. It's happening in the sea. This is, it's doom and gloom, basically. But this is a good news story, because we've actually stopped hunting whales.
Yeah.
Well, the ocean used to be like the land. It used to be full of enormous animals. But we killed them all. But now, they're coming back. So hardly a year passes now without people seeing whales of various species in places where no one in living memory has ever seen whales. You see reports all the time in the media. My God, such and such a whale. We've never seen that before. Where did they come from? There's nothing odd about this. They're just recolonizing all the places they used to live before we killed them all. So people have seen humpback whales just off the coast of Cornwall.
Yeah.
For example. I mean, that's just, you know, and people are gobsmacked, but they shouldn't be, because they would always have been there before we started killing them. Now, what did these animals do? Well, they did all kinds of things. Nutrient circulation in the oceans, moving nutrients around the ocean from surface waters down to deep water and deep water and back up to surface waters and so on. That was whales' job. That was what whales did. They were the great nutrient circulators in the ocean. And suddenly they're coming back and they're going to start doing it again. And the ocean's going to work a lot better as a result. Because the oceans are still, you know, despite overfishing, they are still basically wild.
Yeah.
Whereas there are too many people on land for too much of that to be terribly wild, to be honest. Mind you, we try in small ways, don't we? I'm really excited down here in Devon at the reintroduction of pine martins.
Yes, yeah.
To Dartmoor. I mean, it's a, you know, it's a small thing. But seriously, what's not to be like?
Well, yeah, big things start small, don't they? So it's better than taking no action whatsoever.
Big things start small, and small gets people used to the idea that of reintroducing animals that used to be around but have been long locally extinct. So, I mean, you know, pine martens belong on Dartmoor. They will always have been on Dartmoor. The woodlands of the Dartmoor River valleys would always have had pine martens in them. But we killed them all.
Why did we kill them all? What was the reason?
Well, various reasons. All the small mustelids, the martins, weasels, polecats, we like their fur. They've got lovely fur. Very fine, very warm. I mean, just beautiful for warmth and for decoration. I mean, you could just think how many animals you had to kill to get all those ermine in the House of Lords. I mean, seriously, or a king's coronation. Although, to be fair, King Charles recycled old coronation robes. They didn't have to kill any new weasels to make his robes. So that's one reason. And then later, when we got more and more people and more keeping more and more animals, they were regarded as vermin because of people keeping chickens, just like foxes.
Yeah.
So various reasons. But anyway, they were reduced at one point to just basically a few left in northwestern Scotland.
What is that? Pine martens?
Pine martens. But wow. now they're spreading. Now they're spreading naturally. They've been reintroduced into Wales, where they're doing really well. And as I say, Dartmoor also. And I think Exmoor also. So that gets people used to the idea of that and beavers.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because I can't believe how much opposition there was throughout almost the whole of my life. People have been banging on about what a good idea it would be to reintroduce beavers. But the opposition was, I don't know, kind of weird in a way. I think we don't like change in a way. We like the world the way it was when we were growing up or something. We don't like change. There was a lot of opposition to beavers. I've no idea why. No idea why. And in the end, it took people basically taking the law into their own hands.
Well, yeah, people near from where I'm originally from, Canterbury, I think, released some beavers into nearabouts the Stodmarsh Marsh area secretly. And then now they're everywhere, but there's actual like a formal project to introduce them back as well going on. And I think there's not been too many problems. The only problem I would expect people to be annoyed with would be potentially flooding farmed land, but I don't know how bad that actually is or how often they do that.
Well, it's not a real problem. Near where I live, there are beavers on the River Otter in East Devon. Again, originally, unofficially. And, you know, Natural England were, of course, initially, oh my God, we can't have this. We've got to get rid of them, you know. But there was such local opposition to doing anything about them that in the end they had to give way and say, okay, we'll leave them. But Exeter University have conducted a big study of what they do with beavers. And the news is almost all good. Their effect on the rivers, their effect on fish populations in the rivers has been entirely positive. Their effect on flooding has been entirely positive. There has, as you suggest, been a small amount of flooding of low-lying farmland. But basically, that's one of those things where if you agree to compensate farmers for that, the cost is trivial and the benefits are enormous. So beavers are back and, you know, not in my lifetime, but in yours maybe, they'll be everywhere. It'll be norm. And of course, the problem with all this is being a bloody island.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, all this would have happened naturally, because beavers are recovering right across Europe. And if only they could get here without being physically introduced, they would have done. You know, you'd have actually had to stop them invading rather than, you know, bring them.
Well, do you think that's the problem, partly? It's the fact that we're an island and we're closed off from the rest of Europe. That natural process doesn't happen. So people are naturally more opposed to reintroductions.
Yeah, I think being an island has got a lot to do with... It's got a lot to answer for, basically. I mean, let's be honest. Being an island has been quite useful in the past at times. But it does make us feel a bit special, a bit different, in a way that we're probably not, to be perfectly honest. You know, I mean, beavers, lynx, wolves, all the rest, they would all turn up here on their own, if only there was a mechanism for them to do so. And it's one of those things, attitudes change, don't they? The interesting thing is you can't push people to do things they don't want to do. And yet, over time, imperceptibly, attitudes, not just in this area, but across everything, attitudes imperceptibly change. And suddenly you wake up one day, and what seemed a really weird idea 50 years ago seems perfectly normal. You know, I mean, I'm old enough to remember all the arguments about wearing seatbelts in cars. I mean, seriously.
Have you seen videos of in America when they introduced it, and they'd interview people on the side of the road, and they'd say, like, they'd ask them like what they think about it, and they'd have their kids in the back, and then there'd be, I think it was to do with banning alcohol, actually.
Yes.
Like drinking while driving.
Yes.
And they were like, oh, this is a communist country. Like, it can't be having this. This is against our yeah. rights. And it was drinking in the car.
Yeah. It's just driving along drinking, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, drinking and driving is another one. But, you know, that and seatbelts are both insane, frankly. I mean, and yet, there was a major, really strong pushback against being made to wear seatbelts. It was a kind of major infringement of one's personal liberty to stop you, you know, killing yourself, basically. Yeah. It even quite a slight accident. You can be seriously injured without seatbelt. So nowadays, it's kind of a no-brainer. You get in a car, you put on a seatbelt. You don't even think about it, do you? It's like breathing. And yet, it's an idea that before its time had kind of come, you couldn't persuade people. You just couldn't. You know, people are impervious to logic, essentially. I mean, they just are. And almost the more logical the argument, the less they like it, the more kind of raw emotion takes over, you know. So this is what gives me kind of hope in one sense, that all these reintroduction problems in decades to come will seem less of a problem, less and less of a problem. You know, people will look around and they'll see beavers will become a natural part of the landscape. Lynx will follow, I'm sure. Lynx will be reintroduced. And after a few decades, people will notice that lynx have been here for a long time and the world has not ended. And in fact, not only that, you've never seen a lynx.
Mm.
Because they're secretive, rare forest animals.
It's almost, well, it is kind of shifting baseline syndrome, but in a positive way this time, because...
Yeah, this is positive shifting baseline syndrome. Yeah. Yeah. This is, yeah, it's in a good way.
Yeah.
Shifting baseline syndrome is nearly always a bad thing. But on this occasion, you know, I think eventually it will be a good thing. And then maybe decades down the line, finally, people will come round to wolves, maybe.
What about bears?
Bears, yeah. Bears is a big ask. Bears is a big ask. They really do need lots of room. And they're also the only animal that we're talking about that is actually a physical threat to humans. I mean, if lynx were reintroduced, you wouldn't know. You would never see them. I would never see them. All you would notice is a few less deer and a few more trees. Wolves? Would you notice wolves? You might, occasionally. But are they a danger? No. All these old fairy tales about wolves, you know, Little Red Riding Hood and all that. This is all folklore.
Yeah.
Wolves are not a danger to people.
They're quite shy, aren't they? They're quite scared of
They're quite shy animals. Yeah. They wouldn't be a danger. Bears are dangerous. I've never seen a bear, but I've been to Yosemite. And I noticed there how much emphasis there is in Yosemite on how to deal with bears. You know, keep yourself safe from bears. What to do when camping. How to avoid encounters with bears. What to do if you encounter a bear. It's really big, you know. It's everywhere. And that's because having people visiting the park being eaten by bears is bad publicity, you know. They don't want that to happen. And that's in a place like Yosemite Park, which is huge.
Yes,
and basically empty. Whereas in this country, I mean, England's a non-starter, the bears. Scotland, could you have a small population of bears in Scotland? Maybe. But it's a big ask. I'm not hopeful that bears. I don't think the bear reintroduction campaign has much hope. Not for a long time, anyway.
Yeah. What about bison? Because you said about deer being a problem, eating trees and stuff, but in Kent and maybe in Devon as well, there's Wildwood Trust, which I'm a member of, that have introduced, like semi-introduced bison to like a large enclosure. So what do you think about bison being reintroduced?
Yeah, bison. Yeah. Well, you know, it's another native animal that should be here. Used to be. And again, would go with all these other reintroductions and the general fashion for expanding woodland, because European bison are woodland animals. You know, they're related to the American bison, but ecologically they're very different animals. They're woodland animals. They're not grassland animals. So you would. If there were bison, wild bison, you would mostly not notice them, I don't think. They would just fit in along with the deer. And so they would do some damage to tree regeneration. But again, if you had predators, if you had lynx.
Could lynx deal with bison?
I have no idea. That's a good question, isn't it?
Yeah, you'd think maybe it'd be wolves that would be.
I think it's wolves that would. You'd have to have wolves if you had bison. I think otherwise you'd have the old deer problem, which is that you'd end up shooting them. Which would be silly.
So start with lynx, reintroduce bison. If you reintroduce the bison, you have to reintroduce the wolves as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Start with lynx and work upwards, I think would be a good way to do it.
Yeah.
And it's a very active, you know, there are groups campaigning to, you know, it's a very active area of campaigning. Not one where the door is obviously firmly closed either. So, yeah, I'm hopeful.
Yeah. Well, you've argued that conservation efforts should concentrate on Earth's ecosystems in your Why Do We Need Pandas book. And could you explain why factors like land fertility and, I mean, we've explained forest size a little bit, but soil pH, why do they matter more than focusing on certain charismatic species?
Well, not so much soil pH. I mean, soil pH affects what you can grow. I mean, if you're a gardener, you know that.
Yeah.
Soil fertility. Soil fertility is a very important one. The world is basically not a very fertile place left to itself. Most of the world is a bit nutrient poor most of the time. And therefore, most of the world's plants have evolved to grow in those kinds of circumstances. And one of the problems with the modern world is it's too fertile. Agriculture is just, you know, spreading nitrogen, phosphorus around the planet like there was no tomorrow. And because that's what you do if you want to grow crop.
Why is that a problem?
That's a problem because a relatively small group of plants, this is a major conservation problem in Britain in particular, not just everywhere, but you can see it on the ground in Britain. There's a relatively small group of plants that are equipped to exploit those very fertile conditions. Most of our flora is adapted to low fertility, relatively undisturbed conditions. So agriculture, lots of disturbance, lots of nitrogen, lots of phosphorus is very bad for the great majority of flowering plants. And that's why the intensively farmed landscape is so dull, really. What can you do about that? Difficult, really. If you have a small country with lots of people and you don't want to import all your food, which would only be exporting the problem anyway.
Yeah.
You need agriculture, and you need moderately productive agriculture so that farmers can make a living. Now, there is a little bit of a trend towards not just achieving productivity by shoveling on yet more nitrogen and phosphorus onto the land. Because what farmers are beginning to notice is that eventually doesn't work very well. If you begin to treat the land as a, if you begin to treat soil essentially as a kind of inert medium, yeah, which is just there to hold the roots of your plants long enough for them to take up all this nitrogen and phosphorus you're shoveling on them. If you do that for a while, you're into a law of diminishing returns. It gets the soil you create by doing that becomes less resilient to drought. It blows away when it's dry, becomes less resilient to rainfall. It washes away during storms in the winter. And ultimately, you're going down a route that will lead to the ruin of the farm and the ruin of your business and the, just ruin, basically. So people are, farmers are starting to, you've probably heard of regenerative agriculture.
Yeah.
Yeah, the idea that farmers are now taking more sensible farmers, clever farmers, farmers who are looking ahead a bit, are taking more care of their soil with cover crops, with more legumes. There's even a trend towards incorporating livestock again into arable rotations. And we haven't done that since the Middle Ages. Yeah, I mean, seriously.
Why is that beneficial? Why would that be good?
Well, it's just a way of, it's a way of, it's a way of helping to make the rotation, an arable rotation with, say, a year of fallow with a grazing crop. You can then, what do you do with that grazing crop before you go back to whatever you were trying to grow in the first place, wheat or oats? You put sheep on. And you don't even need to own the sheep. There's a kind of new business evolving, which is rent a sheep, where you may be an arable farmer, but you can actually hire sheep to come in as part of your rotation and graze your fallow. And it's all about soil. Civilization depends on soil. Yeah, I mean, that's it.
Yeah.
Soil is the only thing that stands between us and, you know, starvation.
Is it for that reason? Because we depend on it for food.
Yeah, so it's looking after soil. And all this means that farmers can spend, you know, more organic matter, more legumes, fixing more nitrogen of their own, less phosphorus being washed out of the soil because the soil is more organic matter in it and is more resilient. Means clever farmers who are going down this route are finding they're spending a half or even a third or even a half less on fertilizer than they used to spend.
Wow.
Yeah. And this is all helping to sort of make farming less intensive in a way, and yet not necessarily less profitable. Less in, maybe less out. But in the end, the balance, you know, means that you can still make money.
How does kind of, we were talking about sparing room for like natural habitats to regenerate, how does that play into the farming kind of issue or problem? Is it a good idea to give space on farmland to natural habitats?
Yeah, I think so. Again, farmers are finding that if you have, you know, there was a tendency at one time to regard hedgerows, for example, as totally superfluous, you know, just a waste of space. But what people now realize is that hedgerows are good for the soil, they're good for biodiversity, they're good for pest control, because all the animals that eat the pests in the crop live in the hedgerow. And if you widen the hedgerow a bit, you have strips of wildflowers by your hedgerows around your fields. Those hedgerows and those wildflower strips are full of, they're full of predators. They're full of beetles that come and eat the aphids and the caterpillars in your crop. They're full of pollinators that come and pollinate your crop. And you have a closer approximation to a kind of functioning natural system. And so it's all, there's a lot of movement, in the recent years down in the direction of travel is hopeful, I think, in farming. And this is all gradually lowering the overwhelming sort of fertility of the entire landscape. Of course, there are large chunks of the landscape which have never been farmed, never been fertilized. And that's where most of the biodiversity, especially the floristic biodiversity, still survives. And those areas, we should feel under no compulsion to exploit those areas. We should definitely, if we care about preserving our native wildlife, we should leave them alone, definitely.
So in England is a great, I don't want to say solution, but a great potential solution would be to do that, like widen the hedgerows and then just preserve the small fragments of non-agricultural areas that we have left. Or do you think it's a good idea to also expand national parks and let forests regenerate as well, if in an ideal world?
Yeah, probably both of those, actually. We've a long tradition of a lot of biodiversity living on farms. I mean, in the, you know, if you go back to, you know, the landscape that Jane Austen would have recognized, where farmland was of necessity less intensive than it is now, because there were no chemical fertilizers and it was all done by horses and oxen. Farmland was where a lot of our biodiversity lived. And some of it could, again, as I say, with hedgerows, with wildflower strips, with just preserving little bits of woodland in corners of fields, with farm ponds coming back. Amazing how many ponds there used to be in Britain. I mean, not just ponds, but frankly, another shifting baseline syndrome is how dry the country is now. People don't realize just how wet the whole country was. I mean, just wet, just swamp, mire, rivers, floodplains. You can kind of see why drying it out was a bit of a priority, because you couldn't get anywhere, really. I mean,
really?
Yeah. I mean, before we started draining Britain, it was just wet everywhere. Wet. Bringing anything, any of that back in a small way is helpful. So, yeah, more ponds and on the less, you know, just in less productive corners of fields on farms. It needn't cost anything, really. It absolutely didn't cost anything, because there's money, you know, there's government money to do these things. Various agri-environment schemes pay farmers to do this now. So, yeah.
If we were talking about, shifting baseline syndrome, right? How have you seen the UK's biodiversity change since you were a little boy to now?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I'm not sure I personally have. And let me explain why I think that. Our encounters with wildlife, if we have any, are at home, specifically in gardens. And that's not surprising in a way. I mean, that's, as a child, that's where you spend your time, in your garden. And I don't think garden biodiversity, and there's a lot of biodiversity in gardens, by the way, far, far more than people realise.
Do you want to mention the, do you remember the, in your book, the Leicester suburban garden story?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, this is something I'm very happy to bang on about at the slightest opportunity, which is of course the legendary Jennifer Owen, who should be much better known, the patron saint of wildlife gardening. She spent 30 years recording all the wildlife as far as she could of her perfectly ordinary suburban garden in Leicester. 30 years. And what that revealed was a level of biodiversity that's just astonishing. To me, astonishing. I mean, thousands and thousands of species of insects. In fact, the majority of the stuff she actually caught, she couldn't identify because there were just too many. She was an expert in some areas, but there were just too much stuff for her to identify.
Didn't she discover a few species, new species of parasitic wasp?
Yeah.
If I remember correctly.
Yeah. She looked at parasitoid wasps, which is a group that's very diverse. They're very small and no one takes much notice of them. And she found half a dozen species that were new to Britain, never recorded before in Britain. And she found three or four species that were new to science.
Wow.
Previously unrecorded, undescribed. Just by looking somewhere where no one had ever looked before, in a very ordinary garden in Leicester. And I lay emphasis on the description there of very ordinary.
Yeah.
Because Jennifer Owen's genius was to ask the right question, which is what lives in an ordinary garden? Not a garden where all the stops have been pulled out to try and promote biodiversity, but just a garden that she managed for her own enjoyment with flowers, fruit, pond, lawn, rockery, etc. Not a garden that you or I would regard as in any way unusual. Absolutely amazing. And so that work was carried out in the last 3 decades of the 20th century and showed this astonishing level of biodiversity in gardens. And I think that was probably the case in my parents' garden when I was growing up. You know, that I was just amazed as a small child by frogs and toads. I remember finding toads living under the shed, you know, and just being amazed by just simple stuff, you know, by butterflies and bees. And I still am in the same place in my garden now. You know, I go out and I go and look at my pond and I see the newts swimming around and I see the, you know, all the different species of birds on the bird feeder. And I think gardens have, gardens have preserved a lot of biodiversity that would have been lost otherwise from the landscape that most people encounter every day. So that if you're a small child growing up now, I think you have the same opportunity to go out your front door and see the same kind of stuff in, frankly, the same kind of quantities that I used to see when I was, you know, a small child.
I definitely think gardens are probably the front door to loving nature for many people. That was definitely the case for me growing up. I became obsessed with birds because of Springwatch, but also because of having them in my garden Yeah. And my dad was a massive, is a massive bird nerd as well. He had loads of bird books I used to go through when I was younger. I remember him saying he lived just in front of a railway embankment, which had an orchard the other side of it. Mm. And he remembers nightingales nesting at the back of his garden.
Yeah.
I guess that's a, that's an exception. It's not a, it wasn't an urban garden. It was a, no. It was a rural yeah. one. But
that is an exception. That is an exception. And mostly what the evidence shows is that most of the biodiversity you'll find in a garden is about the same, irrespective of where your garden is. That's not quite true for birds because they're so mobile.
Yeah.
So if you have a rural garden, birds will come into your garden from surrounding countryside that are not urban birds. And so you will see a bigger range of birds in a rural garden. You'd be very lucky to see nightingales, I agree.
Yeah.
But even so, you know, the thing about wildlife is I find just as much fascination in the very common as the rare. There's a bit of an archway out here in the garden, and every morning there's a pair of collared doves that sit on it, looking for all the world like a sort of happily married old couple, you know? And they sit there kind of looking at each other and doing a bit of cooing and having a bit of a peck around, you know, and then they fly off together. And somehow you see them, and every morning they're still there. You're kind of reassured that the world is still functioning as it should do.
Definitely, you know? Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
In a weird way.
It's comforting, isn't it? I've so many stories like that. That's how I began my career as a wildlife photographer, was just observing the birds and wildlife around my garden. I even have a picture of two collared doves on my neighbor's brick wall, like kissing each other, or looks like they were kissing. And
exactly.
Even down here in Cornwall, we've got herring gulls the opposite side of my accommodation, and there's a whole story behind it. There's different nests on different roofs, and there's fights, and then there's the great black back gulls above my building that swoop down, and there's a bunch of conflicts.
You don't have to look very far at all. I mean, I'm not too far from the sea here, and the sky is full of gulls all the time, and quite often way above all of them is a buzzard. And the first thing you know it's there. You just hear this distant, and you go, oh, there he is, you know. And we seem to have a lot of jackdaws here, and I just love jackdaws because you can just tell how clever they are.
Yes, yeah.
They sit there and look at you with their head on one side, like weighing you up, and you could just tell how smart they are, you know. Birds, of course, birds are the tip of the iceberg. Yeah, birds, they're obvious in a way. Although they're not all obvious, but yes. And yet birds, if your garden's got plenty of birds, all is right with the world, frankly, because almost all those birds are brought up, when they're young at least, on invertebrates of various kinds. Aphids, caterpillars, spiders, you name it. And if all that other wildlife that you never notice wasn't there, the birds wouldn't be there.
So they're probably the best indicator species of biodiversity.
Birds are a real indicator. If the birds look healthy in your garden, then everything else is probably healthy too. Yeah, definitely.
Hmm.
Yeah. So birds, you know, so gardens, I'm a bit of an evangelist for garden wildlife. I wrote my own little book on garden wildlife years ago, No Nettles Required. which I still regard as one of my proudest achievements, basically. And people still come up to me and say how much I loved reading No Nettles Required, you know, and the advice about what to do to attract wildlife. But there isn't much you have to do, frankly. Just garden. Just garden. Just grow stuff.
Yeah, is it growing stuff or is it letting stuff grow itself, like we were talking about forests? Or in gardens, do you have to be a bit more hands-on?
Oh, you've got to be a lot more hands-on. You've got to be a lot more hands-on, yeah. Jennifer Owen, again, going back to Jennifer Owen in her Leicester garden, she spends quite a lot of time. She wrote two big books on wildlife in her garden. She spends quite a lot of time going on about, why is all this stuff in my garden? What's it doing? Why is it here? And the conclusion she came to, and is the correct one, I'm sure. And the conclusion is, it's because of gardening. Gardening maintains the world in a state of almost supernatural diversity, structural diversity, and floristic diversity. Tropical rainforest has got nothing on the average garden for different species of plants per square meter. Yeah? I mean, there's nowhere like it in any natural environment. And you've got all these different habitats. Shrubs, trees, herbaceous border, rockery, pond, lawn. And they're all side by side. So in any natural, that's so unnatural. You know, natural habitats, semi-natural habitats, however interesting they are, they're fairly homogeneous. You know, over large areas, they're basically the same. Gardens are not like that. Even within an individual garden, you get this fantastic diversity. So that if you're an insect or a spider or a woodlouse or a centipede or whatever, there's so much to choose from. There's so many different species and so many different habitats and niches, and you'd have to go very far to find them. So it's not surprising when you stop and think about it that this huge diversity of invertebrates is able to live in gardens. Not to say, of course, that gardens are in any way a replacement for those semi-natural habitats.
Yeah.
For ancient woodland, for chalk grassland, heathlands, marshes. We need those as well. They have different wildlife in them. Stuff that never lives in gardens. But gardens as a habitat are astonishing. They really are. We're very lucky to have them.
Do you think that's the best practical actions we can take as just individuals if we're living in an urban area, for example, to increase biodiversity?
Mm. Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. Just garden in a garden with wildlife in mind. Don't necessarily do anything specific. Just grow plenty of stuff. Shrubs, trees, herbaceous plants. Keep the ground covered. Not too much bare ground. Although actually bare ground is good for some things. You know, everything has its use, frankly, in a garden. Even things, and that's... And that's what's so marvellous about gardens. There may be 20 million or more private gardens in Britain, and they're all different. You couldn't make it up, really. If you were designing a nature reserve, and someone said you could have 20 million little plots, every one of them different, you'd go, I'll take that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll have that. That's brilliant. You know, plenty of stuff will live there, and it does. So in fact, yeah, try and provide. Yeah. The key is plants. and bigger plants rather than smaller plants, because plants are habitat and plants are food. So the more stuff you have in your garden, the more habitat there is, the more food there is. But don't overdo it, because if your garden was a woodland, it would be very nice, but it wouldn't be a garden. It would be short of flowers, for example, because woodlands are not good for flowers. And if you want lots of pollinators, which you do, you need lots of flowers. You need lots of flowers. You need plenty of sunshine. So you need open habitats. You need woodland. You need a pond. You need just a variety.
Yeah. In reference to plants, you mentioned Kew Gardens earlier and how they're not trying to plant many more native species. How do you think, looking ahead into the future, what species of plant are likely to replace the ones where we currently have, and what kind of habitat might the UK become if the climate change predictions end up being correct?
Well, the process is already underway, really. I mean, we already have, you know, down here in the south of the country, we already have woodlands of holm oak, Quercus ilex, which is a Mediterranean species, and is now well established and grows really well. You know, our best bet is that by about 2050, which is not far away now, London will have the climate of Barcelona.
Wow.
So that's why you begin to realize that a lot of native stuff is not going to be terribly happy. A lot of native trees and other plants and wildlife is going to be okay in Britain for a long time, but it's just going to slowly move northwards. And there are people who've looked, have kind of shown. The thing about plants is plants move very slowly.
Yeah.
It's a slow business moving if you're a plant. But plants are clearly slowly moving northwards in Britain. It's much easier to observe things moving that are a bit more mobile. So, for example, over the last 20, 30 years, if you look at the northern range margins of moths in Britain, because we have thousands of moths, they've been moving northwards on average about 5 kilometers per year.
Wow.
Every year. Now, what that necessarily tells you is that there's room for new moths in the south. And unlike big animals that don't get to Britain unless we move them, moths can do that on their own because they can fly. So over the last century or so, Britain's acquired nearly 150 new species of moths.
Wow.
New species that are now established in Britain. Nearly all of them are European species, which have simply arrived here on their own without any human assistance. Some people who dislike all foreign species on principle throw their hands up in horror at that and say, oh my God, what can we do? Can't we stop them? And the answer is no, we can't. And in any case, why would you?
Yeah,
because your own native moths are slowly moving northwards, leaving in the south of Britain what would essentially be a moth vacuum, and that's being filled by new species from Europe, not surprisingly. You can see it happening.
It's the same with the speckled wood butterflies, isn't it? They've moved further north. over the last few decades as well. So it's happening in many different species and animals.
Yeah, speckled wood features in Jennifer Owen's garden, because she wrote two books about her 30-year study. And in the first book, there is no speckled wood because it wasn't there. And then in the second book, she says, 1996, speckled wood arrived in my garden. And that's it. It's there. And a little bit further north, because I used to live for many years in Sheffield.
Yeah.
2000, speckled woods arrived in my garden. 5 years earlier, they'd arrived in Jennifer Owen's garden.
Yeah.
They arrived in my garden. By 2010, they were just about the commonest butterfly in the garden. Now, they're a long way north and east of Sheffield and Leicester. They've just kept going. So climate change, you could see it in action. If you just sit in one place for long enough and watch what's passing you on its way north, you could see climate change happening.
Well, even, I don't know if this is 100% related to climate change, but back in Kent, we're seeing loads of vineyards sprouting up everywhere. Do you think that's related to warming temperatures, potentially?
Oh, I think so. I think so, because, you know, people are very quick to spot these kinds of opportunities. And if it becomes more and more difficult to grow, I don't know, strawberries or something that needs, you know, cooler temperatures and more water, or colder winters, you know, like it's getting harder and harder to grow black currants because they need colder winters to make them flower. Why not grow grapes? Great. Yeah, let's do that. I mean, you could say this is all bad news. I mean, you could say, well, this is terrible. But that won't help, would it? I mean, no. It's happening. It's happening, and we're not going to stop it now, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I guess it's just adapting and trying to mitigate it and trying to see new opportunities that arise from it.
Yeah.
Whilst doing what we can to preserve what we have.
Yeah, so. But the wildlife, especially the wildlife that's mobile enough to take advantage, will be way ahead of us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Kenneth Thompson, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for coming onto the show. I really, really loved your book, Why Do We Need Pandas? And that gardening book, I'll definitely read. It sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
But you're actually the first guest that has come onto the podcast. I've got a few more lined up already, but I've really enjoyed it, and I hope you've enjoyed it as well. Where can people find your work? And do you have any new projects coming up?
Not really. No, I'm you know, long retired.
Yeah.
And I just spending my time, you know, enjoying my grandchildren and enjoying my garden.
Yeah.
I write gardening journalism still. I write regularly for which Consumer Association have a gardening magazine, which gardening I write for.
Nice.
Every now and then when inspiration strikes, I write the occasional book. The latest one was Commoner Garden, which is kind of pursuing some of the themes we've talked about.
Yeah.
Because this is an antidote to rarity. It encounters with Britain's 50 most successful. This is saying, let's actually take a look at the plants that make up the world around us.
Yeah.
Rather than worrying about things that just live on some bloody Scottish mountaintop.
Yeah.
Let's look at these complants. I enjoyed writing that. And there'll be another book along before too long, I'm sure. But what it will be about, who knows?
Well, I'll be excited to read all of them. Yeah. And I'll put the links to the books that already exist in the show notes so people can read them if they found our conversation interesting and want to learn more about your fantastic work. But yeah, thank you very much for coming on to podcast, and hopefully see you again soon.
Yeah. Thanks for talking to me.